Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 27th of April. First hour of our program, Bill Nye.
Bill Nye, the Science Guy.
Bill Nye, the Science Guy.
Bill Nye, the Science Guy.
Science rules.
Bill Nye, the Science Guy.
Bill Nye, the Science Guy, is with us this hour of the program. Scientist, engineer, comedian, author, and inventor. His mission, he says, is to help foster a scientifically literate society, to help people everywhere understand and appreciate the science that makes our world work. He says, my family is funny. I mean funny in the sense that we make people laugh, not just funny looking. He tutored people in science and math in high school. His degree from Cornell is in mechanical engineering. He went to work in Seattle as an engineer at Boeing. He won the Steve Martin lookalike contest in Seattle and then developed dual careers as an engineer by day and a stand-up comic by night. Made the transition to his night job as a comedy writer and performer on Seattle's homegrown ensemble comedy show Almost Live, and that's where Bill Nye, the Science Guy, was born. He has won 7 National Emmy Awards for writing, performing, and producing. The show has won 18 Emmys in 5 years. He's also written 5 books for children about science, including his latest Bill Nye's Great Big Book of Tiny Germs. He's the host of the 100 Greatest Discoveries on the Science Channel, The Eyes of Nye on PBS channels across the country, and Planet Green, Stuff Happens, environmentally responsible choices that consumers can make as they go about their day and shopping. For the past few years, he's served as vice president of the Planetary Society. He has patents pending on a device, we got to get this one on the market, to help people learn to throw a baseball better. We'll ask him about that. And the next patent, this brings back memories, an improved toe shoe. For ballerinas, of course. Bill Nye is with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Bill Nye.
Good morning, Kathleen. Is it still morning in Wisconsin?
It's morning. You're in California?
Yes.
And it's definitely morning there. You're up nice and early, sir.
Well, it's all right.
Okay.
It's not that early.
Okay, all right. Do you still ride your bike to work?
Well, the word to work is hard to explain. But yes, when there's a place to go, I ride my bike often. I do work with Disney in Burbank. And that's about 4.5-5 miles I ride there.
Good for you.
But when you're shooting, when you're recording video, it's hard to ride your bike.
Right.
Too much going on.
I want to start with these meteors that fell in Wisconsin, southwest Wisconsin, last week. Some of them are on display now at the Madison Geology Museum. I understand that people came from all over the country to try and get pieces of this, and they would have come from Europe except for the volcanic ash. Why do so many people gather to find pieces of meteors that have crashed?
It's a piece of... of the primordial solar system.
Oh.
It's ancient. It is the star stuff of which we are made. I'm speculating. I think it'd be the greatest thing in the world. Not the greatest, but a very cool thing to have a large meteorite on my desk. Sit and reflect. Think big thoughts. These things, my understanding, these were metallic, like pieces of stainless steel. Now, I have not seen them. I've not spent a lot of time with your Wisconsin meteorites. But it's an exciting object.
Right. So, in other words, you would like for somebody to send you one?
No, I mean, well, sure. But these things, if you have a big one, like the size of, a coffee cup saucer, I mean, I've seen them for $10,000. So, nobody, you don't need to. Please, if you find a meteorite, enjoy it.
$10,000?
Yeah. Seems like a lot of money.
It sure does.
Yeah. I know, at National Public Radio, that's nothing, but to me,
yeah, right.
$10,000 would be a chunk of change. So, yes, we'll just have to wait till one, if I may, falls into my life.
Right.
But there would be, it would be an exciting thing to have.
Why aren't there more of these?
Because where do you think most of them land? Just shoot from the hip there.
I think most of them land in the ocean.
There you go.
All right.
Very hard to find.
Hmm.
This is the exciting thing. Oh, the other thing, if they land in the woods, you can't tell it from a rock unless you're there to see it fall.
Right.
So this is why people like to go to Antarctica and wander around on the ice, find these meteorites sitting up on top.
Everybody worries, Bill, that we're going to have a large one that's going to wipe out a good chunk of some part of Earth.
Very good thing to worry about.
Is it really?
Excellent thing to worry about.
But maybe it won't happen. Are you being facetious, or
no,
is it
I'm
indeed?
No, I'm saying quite likely.
Oh.
And the word quite likely, that's an exaggeration. But every million years or so, there's a very large one that swings by. And as we say in when you're looking for a parking place, or if you're accidentally launching a nuclear weapon, it only takes one.
Right.
So what we at the Planetary Society want you to do is help us look for them, the near-Earth objects, and then help us help people around the world develop technologies to nudge them off course, should we find one.
And are those technologies anywhere near being developed?
Yeah. Yeah.
They are.
The spacecraft, if I can use the expression straightforward idea, is to get a big enough spacecraft out near the asteroid, meteoroid, hurtling rock ice thing, and the spacecraft would have enough gravity on its own that it would just sit near the, it would be on the same trajectory as the asteroid, but it would have very, very small thrusters. And the mutual gravity of these two objects would allow the spacecraft to tow, like a tow truck, to tow the asteroid or the object off its course so it would miss the Earth.
Hmm.
And another just hilariously charming thing is to get a bunch of mirrors and shine sunlight on one side of the asteroid so that it would vaporize. Or asteroid or cometary material, like ice material, have it vaporize, and that the momentum of that vapor going off one way would nudge the object the other way, and then you'd get it to miss the Earth.
Hmm.
It would be big fun.
Mm-hmm. Now,
the ancient dinosaurs almost certainly were taken out by something like this.
And that must have been huge.
Huge enough, yeah. It's generally agreed that the dust went about halfway to the moon. So there's a thing, Apophis. Have you heard of Apophis?
No.
The Greek word, the Greek god of anxiety. So Apophis was going to come by, well, will come by in 2036 and then again in 2038. Now, doggone it, I may be off a year. No, shoot, I should have this at my finger brain, at my fingertips. Anyway, it's around then, in the 2030s. It's going to come by twice.
Right.
And because it crosses the Earth's orbit, down near the orbit of Venus. And so there was, for a while, about a 1 in 10,000 chance. People think it's somewhat less than that now, 1 in 30,000 chance.
Mm-hmm.
And so how much money, how dangerous is, do we spend on, how dangerous is such an object?
Well, that's an interesting question. How dangerous is it? What about those chances? What do we do?
Well, 30,000 is not... pretty good chances for you, but it's not perfect.
Yes.
Not one in a million. No. It's not six sigma, as we say in statistics. You can measure it. I mean, it's one in 30,000, you know, it could happen.
Right.
So the idea is this thing would land in the Pacific Ocean on Friday the 13th in April, and pretty much destroyed the economies of the Western North America and Asia. And that would kind of destroy the world, kind of.
Right. That would be a fairly big event.
Yeah. So you would want to avoid that if you could.
Exactly.
This is an old science fiction deal, you know. Asteroid deflection is a big... We love this in science fiction, but it's based on astronomy.
Right. But what are the chances, really? Friday the 13th?
Well, this is the... Here, you see, as my old professor Carl Sagan said, it's hard to appreciate, but astronomers can predict things to that accuracy. They can tell you when can tell you when the next solar eclipse will be in less than 2 seconds.
Goodness.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Something that would have appeared like magic, as though it were magic to the ancients. And yet we are able to do that. So precise and elegant and wonderful is the dance of the planets, the celestial mechanics, as it's called. And so these people aren't just fooling around when they say there's an asteroid named Apophis that's going to cross the Earth's orbit, and we'd better be careful.
I'll keep my eye on all of this from now on.
As a taxpayer, you want to spend money on it? You go, heck, it's my grandkids. Let them deal with it. I mean, the thing is, you have to, right, in order to have any reasonable, an economically reasonable approach to this problem, you have to get the asteroids when they're way out.
Uh-huh.
You can't do it when they're coming up on you. So then there's going to be arguments. Should it be National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA? Should it be European Space Agency, Japan Space Exploration Agency, Indian Space Research Organization? Who's supposed to take responsibility for making a huge rocket that would have, if not literally explosives, it would have capability of deflecting an asteroid, some technology? I mean, there would be people that would think you're building a space-based weapon.
Yes, but when would we have to get a move on this, Bill?
In the 2018 would be really good.
2018. Yeah. Oh, it's one more thing to worry about.
It's a very reasonable thing. Apophis is, as we say, is probably not the one now, but 4 or 5 years ago, everybody was quite concerned about it. But as you get closer, your radar imaging gets better.
Mm-hmm.
People generally agree that that one's almost certainly not going to hit us. In fact, probably best not to try anything. Like, don't try to mess with it.
Right.
It's really going to miss.
Right.
If you go out there trying to deflect it, there's a chance you'll make it worse. And then when that happens, whom do we sue?
Right.
NASA?
I don't know.
European Space Agency? You know, it's a tough question.
Right. Let's move to this.
It really is rocket science.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Let's move to this volcano. I can't pronounce the name of it, I'm sure.
Eyjafjallajökull?
Thank you. Now that you've done it, I won't have to do it.
Eyjafjallajökull. Icelandic is a lovely language. I cannot say enough good things.
Is it really?
Oh, I think so.
Huh. Do you speak it?
No, I've heard people.
Right.
I was at an event on last Saturday at the California Science Center, and there was a girl, a high school student, who spoke Icelandic.
Huh. Well, there's a talent these days. Did you expect this? Did anybody expect this? And I was it's just amazing to see something like this happen and the modern world not able to do anything about it. You can't fly it. It affects all these people. It was so striking.
Well, we remind us of Mount St. Helens.
Right.
1980, May 18th. And among my other kook ball pursuits, I'm on the board of the Mount St. Helens Institute.
Hmm.
Please donate.
as long as you donate to public radio.
Say again?
As long as you can donate to public radio.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Okay.
You're at it.
All right.
Anyway, the Mount St. Helens Institute, we try to promote the science and beauty and appreciation of the beauty of volcanic landscapes.
Hmm.
So Mount St. Helens is on a subduction zone where the tectonic plates go one under the other, and Eyjafjallajökull is on this rift where the plates are being created. There's the seafloor is spreading and the stuff's coming. But the deal is they both have steam. They both have water underneath them. And that makes this thing just explode. And the ash strikes me as very similar. I don't have a sample of Eyjafjallajökull's ash, but it looks very similar to me. And the ash is like flour, like baking flour. It's like solid rock flour.
Mm.
And when it gets in jet engines, it's just nothing but trouble.
Right.
Back in the 1980s, 30 years ago, there was trouble with a couple of Alaska airline flights that had engine. They had to turn around. They had to get out of the ash. It was not trivial. So the people in Europe were very cautious. And this is the thing. This is not an especially big volcano. I mean, as volcanoes go, it's a volcano, but it's not especially big. The thing is, it happened to be right upwind of London Heathrow Airport.
Right.
Trouble.
Yeah.
And here's another argument, and this is in Europe. It's another argument for trains. Trains are it's a good thing.
Trains are a good thing. People were able to get around because of trains. There's no doubt about that. We're going to go to phone calls in a moment. I just wanted to ask you, which has been all over the place, Stephen Hawking's documentary in which he claimed that intelligent alien life almost certainly exists. The search for it is valuable, but he suggested the potential threats posed by contact with alien intelligence should discourage us from actively sending out messages to the cosmos. What do you think, Bill Nye?
I still think the distances involved are so vast that the danger of attack from distant civilizations is remote. The value of discovering that there are distant civilizations, I think, is, if I may, immeasurable. But people argue about that, and Stephen Hawking has given a lot of thought. So let's take phone calls and argue about it.
All right. We're going to take some phone calls. We don't need to argue, but we could. Our number is 800-486-8655. Bill Nye, the Science Guy, is our guest this hour. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we're going to speak with the author of The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind. Let's go to phone calls for Bill Nye, the Science Guy. Eugene from Viola. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
Your guest. When I was growing up right after World War II, I got a chemistry set for Christmas. And within that, in that chemistry set, they had some solution. They had some chemicals that when you mixed them with water, and then you took a cloth and you soaked it in it, and then took that cloth afterwards and heated it over a stove, it turned blue. Then when you blew through the cloth, it turned white again. And I was often wondering what those chemicals were.
You've wondered about that all these years, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I took it to, this is a country, this was 1947, 48, it's better than almost 60 years ago.
Uh-huh.
More or less.
Bill?
I don't know. Sounds cool. Was it a Gilbert chemistry set?
Oh, boy, they were a lot of fun.
It was a Gilbert?
So, I'm sure there are people that know this without even looking at it. My grandfather was a chemist. My nephew and his wife are both PhD chemical engineers. And they know this without even, they're laughing at me. And I'm sorry, sir. I don't know. But it sounds like carbon dioxide.
Thanks much.
Sounds like bromothymol blue. Boy, it's a deep memory that I cannot recall. Carry on. It was cool, right?
You bet it was.
It was a lot of fun. Chemistry is just a fantastic thing, and we take it for granted until we all have Tupperware and ballpoint pens and ink that sticks to the paper and doesn't get everywhere. And, of course, when we have food that's not full of bacteria.
Right.
We love our chemistry. And what these guys do, what my nephew and his wife, what they do now is they design molecules. That's the way they talk. We're trying to make a molecule that will do this for you. And they do. 150 years ago, molecules were sort of a new idea. No one was really sure there really were such things. It seemed reasonable. No one was really sure.
What's this patent you're working on to help people learn to throw a baseball better?
So there's a couple things. When you go to throw, and I cannot throw, I'm the first to admit, the reason this fascinates me is because I cannot throw. In fact, in baseball terms, I cannot throw, I cannot run, I cannot catch, I cannot hit, nor can I hit for power.
You're not a player.
I am the quintuple threat. Well, I play, but I can't. I'm no good. Anyway, problem is you got to get your elbow, in general, you have to get your elbow above your shoulder.
Okay.
And people don't. then the other big thing you've just got to do, you have to turn your palm away from the direction you're throwing for a moment. This is called turning the ball. And people who know how to throw, this is nothing, of course. Would you grow up in a barn? You know, or did you not grow up in a barn? And so people learn to throw with a sort of, floppy wrist. And the ball doesn't go straight or very far.
Right.
If you learn to get your elbow above your shoulder and turn the ball for a moment, you'll do a lot better.
So you're inventing a device to help you do that?
Yeah, you put your elbow on one thing and you take the ball off another thing and it goes where it's supposed to go.
Oh.
It works very well. And the guy, my co-inventor, is a coach. And he has these things he rigged up on a chain link fence. And it works okay, but not everybody has a chain link fence. And
that's true.
Yeah. Right. And the sports world in general is just replete with devices to help you, help hone your skills. This is one more. But the real invention, Kathleen, the real baseball invention, is the skipper stick.
Oh, I haven't heard of that.
So do you know the expression, hitting a fungo? Hey, audience member, she asked me, okay, don't... She asked me. So do you know hitting a fungo?
No, I don't. Sorry.
You've seen it. The coach has the ball in one hand and the bat in the other.
Yes.
He or she throws the ball up and then hits it with
the
bat.
Okay, that's hitting a fungo.
Some ancient reason this is called hitting a fungo.
Okay.
Fungo practice. You take fungos. You shag fungos, which means you catch fly balls. You shag some flies.
Right, I do know that.
Okay, well, then there's a fungo bat.
Oh.
Especially long and thin for coaches. And the reason it's long and thin is you get tired swinging the bat over and over.
Right.
So what really makes you tired is bending over to pick the ball up. So this is a rubber device that goes on the end of the bat. Our real successful product is where we've made the bat for you so that it's balanced. The rubber thing and the bat combination feel really good. We call the rubber thing, by the way, the fango.
Oh.
Because it has four rubber protuberances. Or teeth. No, wait, they're fangs. So the fango helps you hit fungos. So thank you. Thank you for asking. These are little hobbies. Mechanical engineer Bill has little things.
Is there a picture of this somewhere?
You guys, she asked me, okay?
Right.
It's on my website, and the company that we started out with is D-Bat, which is, I think, stood at one time for Dallas Bats. D-Bat. And there's certain pros, professional players, that insist on D-Bat.
That's really?
Their favorite bat. Well, it's very competitive.
Huh.
And bats, though, like fountain pens, are very personal.
Yes.
The bat, depends on the size of your fingers, your wrist, whatever the heck. Everybody wants his or her own bat.
Right.
D-Bat, they're good guys, and they will set you up with the skipper stick.
All right. You're a man of many talents, Bill.
Well, or is it just wasting everybody's time?
No, I don't think so. Not when it comes to baseball.
Well, baseball is important in the United States. Well, heck, around the world.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It looks simple, but it's so complicated. Oh, my goodness.
I've heard that, and you would know this, hitting a ball with a bat, whatever kind of bat, is one of the hardest human things to do.
As people say, it certainly seems reasonable. I mean, you have considerably less than a second to decide what you're going to do, and if you miss the bat by, a millimeter, you change everything. I mean, it's the difference between a successful base hit or a routine out.
Yeah, isn't that something?
It really is. And it's 90 feet, Kathleen.
90 feet, right.
90 feet
right.
From home plate to first base. And you can hate baseball and everything, but you have to admit that if it were 88 feet, it would be quite different. The guy would usually be safe. And if it were 92 feet, the guy would probably never be safe.
I love it.
So this would be my brother and my father's expression. When you say it's 90 feet, it's a way of saying if things were any other way, things would be different.
Right. Oh, I like that. Let's go to Ron from Milwaukee. Hi, Ron.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say that I saw Bill Nye on a PBS special about the California Energy Initiative.
Oh, yes.
And I know that you can do better than your neighbor, Ed Begley, Jr.
We must crush him. Yes.
Yes. And then you recently, you just made the statement that science believes that a large asteroid or meteor hit the Earth and basically killed off all the dinosaurs. Is there any area that science believes where this might have hit? Was it like the American Southwest? Or
oh, no. It's Chicxulub, Mexico.
Oh, really?
Near Belize.
Okay.
Near Belize?
Yeah. So in 1980, these people were looking, the year 1980, these people were looking for oil. And one of the tricks is to use a magnetometer, a very sensitive compass. And you look for, they throw around the word anomalies, things that are different in the direction that the compass is pointing, both north and south and up and down, what they call dip, like it's dipping. And by 1983, people had satisfied themselves that there was this huge ring under the soil, under the sediment, off the east coast of Mexico and north of Belize. And this is what everybody, people who've given this a lot of thought, believe is where the giant meteorite or collection of rocks or icy body thing impacted the Earth 65 million years ago.
Huh.
Yeah, it's this is another thing where people have this idea, and they, at first everyone thinks that's crazy. But they think about it for 20 years and argue about it, and now everybody's pretty satisfied that that's where it hit and that's what took out most of the ancient dinosaurs. See, we still have dinosaurs. Birds, modern birds, are descendant of dinosaurs. But I have to say, a sparrow and a Tyrannosaurus rex, I think you could tell them apart. I really
right.
I think you could, even on the wide shot, as we say in movies. Yeah.
Thanks, Ron, very much. Well, what they need is a tourist attraction to help the local economy north
of
Belize.
People go down there all the time.
Do they?
My understanding is there isn't that much to see. There's a series of freshwater springs that are also associated with this because it's a hill.
Huh.
You know, water runs downhill underground. And so that's another, there's one more thing to do, doggone it.
Yeah, right. But it would be a fun thing to do, wouldn't it?
So if you live in the U.S., and I get the impression a lot of your listeners do, I strongly encourage you someday to go to Meteor Crater, Arizona. It's near Flagstaff. It's not very far from Phoenix.
Okay.
And it's this enormous hole in the ground that was made by an impactor from outer space. And it's a little bit off the beaten path, but not that far off the beaten path, and it's just perfectly preserved. Because it's so young.
Oh.
Chicxulub is 65 million years old. This thing's more on a few tens of thousands of years old.
Huh.
And so the guy had the idea, a guy named Berenger had the idea, that let's go there and I'll be able to dig up a meteorite, which is essentially a very large piece of stainless steel.
Right.
And I'll sell it and get rich. But it turned out, and his idea was seemed quite reasonable at the time. He shot bullets into mud, because in Arizona, I guess that's what you can do. And you see the shape of the crater, and you infer then the angle that the impactor came in from the sky and so on. But the model isn't very good, or not good enough, because the bullet stays a bullet when it gets into the mud. But in real life, the impactor, the asteroid, meteoroid, icy thing, was made of essentially the same stuff as the Earth's crust, or closely related stuff.
Hmm.
And so there's an underground shower of rock. The thing didn't stay in one piece the way a bullet would. It disintegrated.
Huh.
And so your beautiful stainless steel or whatever is spread out in an uneconomically recoverable
ooh,
way.
Ooh, there goes the money, huh?
And furthermore, in such a fashion that apparently it just destroyed drill bits. Like it's pretty tough stuff. It's like work hardened. You know, it's a knife blade steel distributed as powder underground.
Oh, my.
Well, but it's a spectacular place.
Okay.
That's all.
All right. Peter is next from Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Morning. I read in a newspaper a couple of months ago that still another element had been added to the periodic table, and like so many of the past, it existed for a few milliseconds and then...
Oh, not even milliseconds, yeah,
okay.
But I know what you mean. Yeah.
I guess I'm just wondering, what's the point with that sort of thing?
Well, it may change the world forever.
I'm sure it will.
So, the idea is to understand how atoms are held together,
mm-hmm.
molecules are held together. And so by getting these an extraordinary number of protons, in this case I think you're talking about 117
okay.
protons, to stay together, there's some extraordinary forces involved, which are the strong atomic force, one of the four fundamental forces. And we understand it as best we can, but we don't understand it completely. And it is generally agreed that this force is a result of the exchange of particles. And these are subatomic particles, which have a plethora of names, and they call it the subatomic zoo. But the protons are actually groups of quarks, which are held together by the exchange of gluons, because they're like glue. And then the protons and neutrons are held together by the weak and strong atomic forces, and they're not fully understood. But if we understood them, it is generally agreed, you might be able to harness enormous energies, perhaps the power of the sun right here on Earth, and then it would be easy to get energy, maybe. Also, it might be possible to fabricate new molecules that no one's ever thought of, and then you'd have new materials that no one's yet imagined. And then maybe it'd even be a way to deal more successfully, more economically, with nuclear waste, if you understood all these problems.
Oh, that's interesting.
And this is what we're trying to do in CERN, in Switzerland.
I thought that was the opposite.
Well, I mean, you're trying to understand what's inside.
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you.
Thank you, Peter. We go next to Brad from Rhinelander. Hi, Brad.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, you?
Not too bad.
Good.
Not too bad. Bill, just want to say I'm a huge fan. Grew up watching you as well as my son. He really loved your show.
Right on, that's great.
quick question. I guess with the recent seismic activity that's going on and volcanoes, and it got me thinking because I watched that awesome movie from like a year ago, 2012, and it made me wonder, with the alignment of the planets and everything that's going on, do we really have something to worry about within the next few years?
No. Absolutely not. No. Not with regard to the... You understand, the planets align all the time.
Okay.
They go around the sun all the time, and they line up all the time. Just the mutual gravity of planets is quite small. Jupiter, pretty good size. Saturn, pretty good size. But Venus, Earth, Mars don't have all that much to do with each other gravitationally.
Okay.
Earth and the sun, we're huge fans of that. So what happened with 2012, the Mayans had this big round rock, fabulous rock. Now, in those days, I imagine it was quite difficult to get a rock to be round. You didn't have steam drills or hydraulically driven rock-moving equipment. Instead, I imagine it was done by diligence chipping away at the problem, if I may. So they finished this round rock, and they recorded their history along the circumference of the rock. And if you look at a picture of it, it's not difficult at all to find a picture of this rock online, you will see where they ran out of room. They used up the rock. So they wrote on there, time to get a new rock, which we interpret as time for a new era It's the end of an era, the end of days, parenthesis, because we need a new rock. And I have a nice little book about this. Furthermore, the expression 2012 is probably not that accurate. It's like it's not clear when the Mayans, it's not completely clear when the Mayans started their year counting and how it lines up with our year counting. You know, this used to, what we now call the Common Era used to be called Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. But there, apparently, and I'm not an expert on this, don't go busting my chops on this, but apparently even 2,000 years ago, people lied about their ages.
No.
Yes, and pretended that they were a little younger than they were. So apparently the Common Era differs from the year of this guy's birth by about 4 years. So that adds, I'm not saying that's the whole story, but it adds one more, it's an example of the kind of thing that goes wrong when you try to coordinate calendars that were invented on opposite sides of the earth in ancient times before the internet.
Right.
And so, like back in the 1980s or something. No, it's even longer ago than that. And so, there's some controversy in the scholarship world about when the calendar was started. Or not controversy, there's some, let's call it, you can't pin it down. Maybe it's not controversy. Everybody agrees you can't be sure. And so, I just wouldn't worry about 2012 in that regard. If you want to worry about things, and I think that's a great thing to do.
Oh, sure.
Well, climate change is going to be trouble.
Yes.
And every
yes.
year that we put off doing something about climate change, the difficulty with setting things back right gets bigger.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about that. And thank Brad very much for the call.
Yeah,
it's
thank you, guys.
One less thing to worry about. I'd make some plans for that year. Tell me what signs you're seeing that climate change is very real right now, and there are a lot of scientists who are worried about a tipping point already happening.
Oh, man, yeah.
Do you share that worry, Bill?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
No, the United States is unique in having people that don't believe in climate change.
Right.
I mean, this is a great, it's a wacky thing that we have. And What it all comes down to is people are not. It often comes down to debating credentials. Well, that he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's a member of the conspiracy of climate change people.
Mm-hmm.
Like the United Nations has coordinated. The claim is the United Nations has coordinated 10,000 different people around the world to be in on this joke.
Mm-hmm.
But I always remind people when it comes to conspiracies. They're not that easy to pull off because you work in a company, right, in Wisconsin Public Radio, and there's probably some office politics that you find disturbing.
You're kidding. Not here. No.
When people are trying to work together, they can't work together, let alone
yes.
when they're trying to undermine things.
Right. I see your point.
So that right there I always find kind of, are you sure about this, people? So the evidence for climate change is overwhelming, and I say this not as a professional climate scientist. I say this as a scientifically literate guy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you read the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, AR4, Assessment Review 4, the evidence is astonishing. The thing is, it's so complicated. If there's so many different things, what people call forcings, and this is a term I always think of as being derivative of control theory, of setting a car on cruise control or a thermostat in a house, or a swing set where you push the kid on the swing,
mm-hmm.
you add a little force every time the kid comes back to you, or you damp it out, you take out a little force when it's time to go in, like enough swinging. So these are called forcing functions or just forcings. The interaction of these forcings is so complex that you can make climate models, or these are mathematical computer simulations of the Earth climate, that vary quite a bit. They don't all show the same answer depending on what assumptions you make. With that said, the evidence that the world is getting warmer, in accordance with the best or any reasonable models, is overwhelming. And future generations will laugh at us, if there are any of them, because we're just messing around with this problem. So the deal, just fundamentally, you add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere or other greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, it holds in more heat. But it doesn't, if you add carbon dioxide this year, the world doesn't get warmer this year. The world gets warmer over many years. It takes years to accumulate heat in the atmosphere, and especially heat in the ocean. The ocean's holding huge amounts of heat. And so this lag, this delay, is what's could bite us. It just, things are happening more slowly. Things seem to be happening more slowly than they're really happening.
So what should we do today?
Everything all at once. That's my opinion. We should find ways to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. We should find ways to stop deforestation and plant more trees, take carbon dioxide out of the air. And the big thing, that climate, or rather carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions, are intimately tied to energy production. When you burn coal or oil or gas, you use huge amounts of energy that you produce huge amounts of energy that put carbon dioxide in the air. And this is, carbon dioxide's not the strongest greenhouse gas, but it's there's so much of it that and the other thing, it's being put there so fast. Putting it in the air so fast. The very strong greenhouse gas is water vapor, but I'm a big fan of water vapor. Carbon dioxide is what we're adding to the air. And the other just amazing thing, carbon dioxide is almost 390 parts per million in the atmosphere. That's 0.04%. It seems like a tiny amount. It just seems like such a small fraction. How could it make any difference? But I remind everybody that every animal you've ever met, including humans, and my old boss, rely on plants, which make their entire living off this 0.04%. So it seems like a small number, but it's very, very significant.
Bill Nye, our guest. More phone calls momentarily. Email address, talk@WPR.org. Phone number, 800-486-8655. Our number two of our program today, will be speaking with the author of The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain, The Surprising Talents of the Middle-Aged Mind. The author is the deputy science editor and health and medical science editor at the New York Times. So that's coming up. Hour two. Bill Nye, the science guy, is with us now. Our next phone call is Gene from Oshkosh. Hi, Gene.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Bill. I have a legitimate question, but first an observation. You know, I am so surprised that scientists have senses of humor. I thought it was like my own field, which was financial economics, where we were driven solely by pride or whatever.
Well, when you go to the party with the accountants, that is a laugh riot.
Yeah, I believe that. By the way, Bill, you've got to understand that if you ask questions that Kathleen can't answer about baseball, pretty soon she's going to be sleeping with the dog.
My husband's a baseball columnist, Bill. That's
my legitimate question. A few years after Mount St. Helens blew, first of all, it was still tremendously impressive, especially on the east side.
The downwind. You know, Seattle was hardly affected at all.
Right.
Very close, 50 miles.
Yeah. So we chose to come down the east side rather than the west side. We found some very, very large and long lava tubes. And about half the time I understand the physics of how these tubes are formed, and the other half I haven't a clue. Would you tell us what these lava tubes are and how they are
formed? So you visited Mount St. Helens?
Pardon me?
You visited Mount St. Helens.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I think that's a key fact here. So anyway, when you've got magma, and I'm not an expert on this, but I spent a lot of time there. When you have magma on the surface, be lava, glowing hot orange lava, it cools off on top first, and then it's often it'll keep flowing underneath. It cools off on top because it's facing the sky. The stuff underneath then gets insulated, so then when the lava stops flowing, you end up with a hollow space with a roof on top. But the same thing can happen when you have ice interacting with it. The ice can support a roof while lava goes underneath. And I'm pretty sure there's some phreatic, this is to say some steam-driven things. There's a phenomenon called a lahar, where rocks are flowing downhill on a layer of steam. It's like, if you're an animal in the way of a lahar, man, that is serious trouble, or a tree. And so these things then can support rock for a while, or plastic rock that's not fully solid while stuff flows underneath, and then it firms up and you end up with a lava tube. They're spectacular things. I mean, some of them are couple stories high, you know, 20 feet, 3 or 4 meters high, and you walk through them. It's amazing.
Thanks, Gene, for your call. Here are a couple emails that have come in at the risk of having you cry again. I first discovered Bill Nye when I was a student at the University of Washington in the early 90s and became an instant hero, you did, to me. Thanks, Bill, for taking the stigma out of being a science nerd and for helping me instill a love of science in my own children. You totally rock, Donna from Milwaukee.
Very nice.
That is nice. Second one, I'd be curious to know if Bill's done anything for golfing. The ball is much smaller, so that would seem more difficult. Most golfers could use the help. What can you do, Bill?
I'm not a big golf. I wasn't brought up with golf. I completely understand it. And my big love in physics is fluids, the flow of fluids. And air is a fluid. Anything that flows is a fluid. And boy, the energy people put into getting golf balls to fly with the least aerodynamic drag is pretty impressive. I mean, millions, maybe, well, let's call it tens of millions of dollars have been spent developing a low drag golf ball. So I leave that to people who are literally more invested.
Okay. Thanks for the emails. Let's go next to John from Green Bay. Hi, John.
Good morning. Bill, thank you for being on the show. I was wondering if you could explain to me and to the listeners why the one side of the moon always faces the Earth, the same side.
Well, it's a cool mathematical thing where there's a resonance, a natural frequency where the moon spins once for every once it goes around the Earth. And so I'll just tell you, in math, this is called an eigenvalue. It's a German word, a proper value. And so the moon spins once, it goes around the Earth once. And by the way, the moon has a little wiggle to it. So actually, if you're keeping careful records, you see a little more than half of the moon because it's... at the same time it's going around. But this is a unique thing, and literally, I guess, unique in more than one way. And it's fascinating. But this resonance is connected, or rather has to become out right when you're going to make a model of how the moon was formed. You better make it so that the impact, the thing that hit the Earth that became the moon, leads to this proper value where it spins once for every once around the Earth. And I was brought up that the Earth's 365 and a quarter was an eigenvalue. But I think that's too many things have come by the Earth and disturbed it. It's no longer synced up, you know, on its proper value. It's wiggled out of it a little bit. But all this stuff, these interactions and these resonances are the stuff of celestial mechanics. This is the, This is rocket science. And this is this is what makes it all so fascinating. And by the way, what we want to do now is get NASA to send people out to these places, these mathematical places where your orbital speed, your tendency to go off in a straight line but being held in by gravity, is in balance with the pole of the Earth, Moon system, and the pole of the Sun. And these places where the gravity and the acceleration of going around the Sun are in balance are called the Lagrange points, named after a mathematician that spent a lot of time with us.
And people will have to go to find out more information on the Internet. We're out of time. Bill, you're wonderful. Thank you so much.
This was big fun.
It was big fun, and we learned things, too. What more can you ask for? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Connor O'Brien for on-air production. And thank you for all of your calls. Wish we had them on all day. We'll return with more Tuesday Conversation.